Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have with us Stanley Kurtz. Stanley is a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He earned his PhD in anthropology from Harvard University. He's a prolific author and commentator. He has turned his attention in recent years to issues of higher education, especially the sort of broader intellectual climate of higher education. He's the co-author of the Campus Free Speech Bill, co-authored with the Goldwater Institute, a bill that is finding great success in the last year or so with state legislatures. But in the last week or two, he has published another proposal. This was a National Review, and this was a proposal for something called the Campus Intellectual Diversity Act. And that's really going to be our springboard for discussion today. Stanley, welcome.
Mark, thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's get right to it. Or actually, maybe I should say, what is the background of the Campus Intellectual Diversity Act? One might be able to figure out a little bit about what it says, what it calls for, but what led you to this proposal?
Well, Mark, I think we've seen since really the 1960s an ever-rising domination of America's college campuses by an intellectual monoculture. And in recent years, that domination has taken a really alarming form. Of course, people have heard about things like trigger warnings and safe spaces, and that occasioned even some good humor when it first came up. But these campus shoutdowns, which are not at all an entirely new phenomenon, but which have really burgeoned in the last few years, have alerted people to the dangerous climate on campus. And of course, the shoutdowns themselves are only the tip of the iceberg, because they reflect and reinforce a climate of self-censorship on campus. And we've also seen these shoutdowns leaking out into the larger culture. We've seen politicians chased out of restaurants, and we've seen congressional hearings shouted down. So I think there's increasing concern for many Americans that our most fundamental value of free speech is now under threat, and that in many ways the source of that threat is the college campus. Now, I because of all that, I co-authored a model bill to restore campus free speech to America's public universities, and that has, as you mentioned, that's gotten some traction in state legislatures around the country. But the truth of the matter is that that's only a part of the problem. It's one thing to say that when a speaker that runs afoul of campus orthodoxy goes onto campus, he might get shouted down. But the truth is, very rarely are conservative speakers certainly even invited to college campuses. And almost never will you see actual debates staged between people who really disagree about the fundamental public policy controversies of our day. So that's why I decided to put forward this proposal, the Campus Intellectual Diversity Act, which would essentially create an office, the responsibility of which would be to put on debates, panel discussions, and individual lectures, drawing in people from opposite sides and divergent sides of our public policy controversies.
Stanley, you said something a few minutes ago that hadn't really occurred to me before, but I could remember when political correctness was really a target of humor. You'd see on TV shows people mocking political correctness, the oversensitivity or stumbling over the wrong words. You don't see those jokes anymore. It's not funny anymore. And I think it's because people sense that this threat of political correctness, it's not just a silly thing going on college campuses where things are somehow kind of antic now and then, that the stakes of enforcement of political correctness really have gone up.
That's exactly right, Mark. And I think of it as taking place in three phases. The first phase was the culture war that we had in the late 1980s and early 1990s over campus political correctness. It was really kicked off in many ways in 1987 by Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind. And shortly after that book was published, and it rapidly rose to be a surprise number one on the bestseller list, we had this national controversy kicked off by Secretary Bill Bennett, who was education secretary at the time, over Stanford University's decision to cut out its Western culture or Western Civ requirement. So this battle raged on until about the mid-90s, and then you saw...
Now, I was getting my degree at the time in the humanities down at UCLA, so those culture wars, canon wars, sometimes they were called, in the academic theater, from what I saw, the academic left, the enforcers of political correctness, were completely trounced in the public sphere. Out there, off campus, political correctness really had a bad word, and it did a lot of damage to the reputation of the humanities, the softer parts of the college campus. But that didn't kill political correctness on campus at all.
Absolutely, Mark. And... you know, the divergence that we saw back in that period of the campus culture war was that the campus left, the censorious campus left, lost in the culture at large, but it won on campus itself. And we saw something like that much later, even with Lawrence Summers. Say Lawrence Summers made some remarks just throwing out as a possibility that there might be a genetic aspect in the differential performance of men and women in mathematics, not because men were smarter per se, but because they had a higher variation between the likelihood to be very bad and very good at mathematics. And that was just thrown out as one of many possibilities. Well, the public clearly did not think that Summers ought to somehow lose his job or be censured for that, but the Harvard faculty voted to condemn Summers, and that exemplified the continuation of this split between the broader public and the campus. But what we see now is a new generation brought up in K through 12 and in higher education that has drunk in and made a part of itself, some would say an almost alternative secular religion, this campus political correctness. And that is what has started scaring people, because when people take all that seriously, it's very frightening. But the middle phase ran from about 1995 until, say, 5 or 6 years ago. And during that phase, there was this thing we were just talking about, the kind of sense of humor thing. I think during that period, conservatives especially would roll their eyes when they would hear a story about some sort of campus craziness. That was a period when there was a lot of publicity given to postmodern jargon. There used to be an award that would go out for the most jargon-laden piece of academic prose, and I think that encouraged people to just laugh at the whole thing. It certainly seemed irrelevant, because how could all of that impenetrable jargon actually make an impact on public debate? People thought. But in fact, I think the professors were vindicated in the sense that their confidence that having that captive audience and controlling their grades and their futures would allow them to change American culture and politics, I think, has been vindicated over time.
You know, it's a funny thing. As an anthropologist, you may understand this better than I would, but it's a funny thing when something has a certain status in a society at one time, and it's the same thing, but at a later moment, it has a different status. It may not be, it's not funny anymore. Suddenly, something that looked harmless now seems dangerous. And the situation that I see is, you know, conservatives, a lot of them, yeah, you roll your eyes at the silliness, but a lot of people on campus are actually pretty nervous, and that includes my moderate liberal colleagues. Everyone feels a little bit wary, and didn't. One could make jokes before, not anymore.
Absolutely, Mark. You know, I'm just I'm doing a little bit of writing. It hasn't come out yet, but I've been looking into some of the professors who were writing around the time of this Stanford University controversy.
This
And I
was
came
88,
about
89.
88, 89, and I came upon the work of someone named Herbert Lindenberger, a literature professor, and he had a practice a couple of times of having a kind of tongue-in-cheek interview with himself. And he interviewed himself about postmodernism, and he attacked himself in his interviewer persona as taking a posture that was going to drive away students, drive away public support, in effect kill the goose that laid the golden egg, and do his own discipline in. And Lindenberger, the interviewee, said, "Well, you have a point there." And it was all done in fun. There was a sense of humor about the whole thing. And now there's no humor about that. And I know you yourself have written eloquently again and again about the decline of the humanities. And at that time, it was a joke. He raised the possibility almost because it seemed impossible that it could really happen. How could you really kill off the humanities? And yet, in a sense, they've done it.
Well, a report came out a few months ago. The history major from 2011 to 2017 lost more than 30%, went down more than 30% in those few years. English, foreign languages, and philosophy all went down more than 20% in a very short period of time. So what we see is a lot of the undergraduates, a lot of the students are going away. Now, I'm sure they're going away for other reasons, but one thing that a lot of the censorious ones, the scolds, they don't realize, people don't want to be in a room with you for 14 weeks. They may not, I mean, there may be a certain portion of kids who would be humanities majors otherwise, but they don't want to be graded by you. You're not pleasant to be around. You're a downer.
Well, I think that's all correct, Mark. And one of the problems with the academy is that it's a difficult place to reform because academic freedom is real and needs to be respected. But one of the reasons that I propose this Intellectual Diversity Act, which is really not about the classroom, but about bringing in outside speakers, again, for debate and discussion, is that it gives us a way to do something about the academy that won't interfere with the classroom. And yet, at the same time, I think if you found conservatives and liberals, both bright, arguing serious public policy issues in the university, it would have a kind of bounce back effect into the classroom. And people would say to themselves, "Well, why don't we have more teachers at this school who represent these other perspectives that I'm hearing for the first time?"
What are the provisions of the proposal, of the Campus Diversity, Intellectual Diversity Act? How's it going to do this?
Well, there are really two core provisions. First, the Office of Public Policy Events, which is what would be established by this act, is required to arrange debates, panel discussions, and individual lectures about the big public policy issues of the day from opposing and divergent perspectives. And second, and crucially, they've got to keep a complete record of who's been invited, what the topic was, what the sponsorship was, not only of the events which this office creates, but all the other public policy-related events on campus, which will create a kind of giant list by the end of the year that will make it very clear to the public and to the legislature whether the events on campus about public policy have been one-sided or not.
Stanley, come on, are you telling me that there isn't a 50-50 breakdown of pro-life and pro-choice speakers on campus?
Well, it's interesting because one of the things that spurred me into making this proposal is research that was done by a professor of political science and public policy named George Lanoux. And Lanoux actually found, it's hard to find for every campus, but he found for many campuses accessible public calendars from 2014 and 2015, which listed all of the public policy-related events. And essentially what he found was that there, and he was focusing particularly on debates, And you would think that, say, abortion would be is obviously actively debated in the country at large. Why wouldn't that be debated on campus? But he found that there were no debates on almost any subject at all. There were maybe a couple of debates, from relatively speaking, on healthcare issues and environmental issues. And it's not even completely clear that those were really right-left debates. They could have been debates from different segments of the left. But most of the big issues, including life issues that are debated in the country, according to Lanoue, just don't get debated on campus. Now, there are a couple exceptions, and that would be the most prestigious colleges that have very large endowments and a big law school will have a few more of these events than most schools. But in the vast majority of cases, there literally is no exposure to actual debate over public policy issues on campus, and that's what this proposal hopes to change.
Now, 15 years ago, David Horowitz tried to lead an academic freedom initiative that would plant more diverse viewpoints, more speakers from the other side. And one of the criticisms thrown back at him was, well, you're going to force campuses to give credibility to people like Holocaust deniers. You're going to force us to bring those kinds of people on campus and give them a voice. What do you respond there?
Well, being aware of that issue, I carefully drafted this proposal, and the model bill says that the legislature gives no direction on the specific topics or the specific speakers or even the specific number of events. It simply says, in an strictly aspirational way, you should try to hold a large number of events. You should try to get events focused on the most widely discussed public policy issues, and you should try to get well-spoken representatives of the main sides. But those are strictly aspirational statements. So there is no controlling language that would allow a legislature to force a campus to hold a debate on any given issue. There is still all the discretion is actually still in the hands of the university. Now, if at the end of the year you produce a list that public writers like you and I could point to and say, well, this is a joke, you know, they were supposed to have a lot of debates and they haven't done it on the big issues, I think that will be clear, but it's a kind of gestalt reaction that people will have. There won't be any particular thing that you're allowed to say, well, you were supposed to have a debate on that and you didn't.
You know, I took that objection with as much seriousness as it deserved. I mean, who in the world, I mean, do you think that conservatives want Holocaust denying? I mean, to me, it was a failure. And what we may see here with your proposal, it's a failure of the professors and the administrators to realize that there is a range of intelligent and solid opinion on the issues that it goes well beyond your particular preference. And it only reinforces the necessity of this kind of proposal because it says you yourselves have failed to be exposed to so many other opinions than your own that you can't even recognize another opinion as something not out there, wild and extreme.
I think that's right, Mark. I guess there's a mixture in these things between the people who really have become so locked inside of their own bubble that they don't really understand that there are people outside of it. And on the other hand, people who understand perfectly well that they are intelligent representatives of a contrary point of view that is not wild and crazy. And that's exactly why they don't want them to come anywhere near campus, because someone might take them seriously and listen. And I think both of those things are going on, maybe sometimes within the same person. I remember teaching at a program for a few years at Harvard, at which the big debate was between the followers of Michel Foucault and the followers of Jürgen Habermas, essentially between a kind of neo-Marxism and postmodernism. This was strictly a debate on the left. And if you'd said to them, you don't have any debates, they would have said, what are you talking about? We are constantly at each other's throats. But of course, it was all on the extreme left.
Right. Now, what you implied a few minutes ago is there is no real enforcement mechanism here, but you talked about the Gestalt. What the record will do is allow parents, alumni, and politicians to say, look, we're not demanding any kind of quota. We're not. But come on. Let's see a little richer intellectual atmosphere. Let's see the fact that, you know, if you want to say, if you want to have a forum on Donald Trump, can we acknowledge that 63 million people did vote for him? And so your panel of being universally anti-Trump doesn't quite cut it. I mean, come on.
Well, you're right, Mark, but I would say there is an enforcement mechanism. I don't think it will be successfully able to be wielded against, you know, one debate that was not held that some legislature wants. But what the legislature could do, if after several years of trial, there were still consistently only one side of the cultural and political spectrum was represented, the legislature could say, well, you've asked for an increase in your annual appropriation. Why should we give it to you? We just passed a bill a few years ago saying that you're supposed to have an office to encourage debate of public policy issues from many different sides. And the record shows that you're clearly not doing that. But again, I don't think that sort of thing would have a chance of passing just because one particular issue or one particular debate. But again, if the total record after several years is evidently one-sided, then I think there would be a way for the legislature to say, unless you can get your act together on this, why should we accede to your request for an increase in appropriations?
Do you think that the college leadership will, perhaps secretly, be in favor of this legislation precisely because it takes a bit of the decision making out of their hands about the intellectual climate of the campus, that when students protest a conservative speaker showing up and outside the president's office, he says, look, we have here intellectual diversity that is really a broad state policy here. This isn't, you go to the state capitol, complain to them.
I think that's right, Mark, but I think that the administrators will be torn. On the one hand, it'll be just as you say, if they're actually confronted by protesting students for having invited, say, a pro-life speaker, they can say, well, look, you know, there's a state law now that we have to have events on major public policy controversies from both sides, and that will be a boon to them. But on the other hand, they will be very uncomfortable with the law precisely because as soon as they start inviting those sorts of people, there will be protesting students who come and get on their case. And that will scare them to death.
Well, but you know what, Stanley? They, if the protests do not work, they're not going to keep doing it. The reason why they keep protesting is because it works, and also because they're never punished rarely punished for their shoutdowns. But I think that look. You protest this campus, this conservative speaker, look at the agenda. There are more coming. And, you know, so.
That's it. I think that's absolutely right, Mark. The goal is, I think it's going to be a bumpier ride in the short term and maybe a little bit in the medium term. But once this thing really takes hold, once this proposal is passed and is worked on for a few years, I think students will begin to look at the idea of a conservative speaker coming on campus and shrug and say, what else is new? It happens all the time.
If you don't like it, show up, ask tough questions, bring in strong counter evidence. But I think you realize that this point of view is held by many, many people in the American public. You can approach it as wrong. You can't approach it as an abomination. Now, you can approach it as an abomination if you're never exposed to it on campus, if you never hear about it in any of your classes. But if it's a regular feature of the extracurricular activities, you can't see it as abnormal anymore. Mistaken, wrong, erroneous, fine. But it's not the act of miscreants.
I think that's right. I think, obviously I'm biased, but I'd like to believe that if this particular proposal takes hold, it will have a more transformative effect even than the Goldwater model bill, which I advocated for before. The Goldwater bill protects the right of free speech. But I think if you have a situation as is proposed in this new legislation, where you just have a regular debates, regular appearance of people on both sides of our very biting public controversies, and that becomes the order of the day on college campuses, it would truly be a new day. And even if none of it happened in the classroom, I think it would create a radically new atmosphere, not just in the sense that there wouldn't be shoutdowns, but that people would just have a whole new attitude toward the intellectual substance and respectability of both sides of the political spectrum.
Well, when I see the shoutdowns happening, one of my first responses is to think, this may be able to happen on a college campus in a constrained fashion, and there won't be any consequences for this. But this is not how to conduct yourself in the real world when you leave here. And you have to join a democratic polity. This is very a very poor training ground for citizenship.
Well, that's it. And so this is what you're saying is this is about education. Part of college education goes on in the classroom, but having outside speakers and listening to debates has always actually been part of a college education, and that's because It makes you a knowledgeable and thoughtful citizen. And that is part of what our colleges do. And that's been true ever since Thomas Jefferson's day. We may have lost the feel for that, but this is very much within the legitimate umbrella of what colleges ought to be doing. And it's something I think legislatures have a right to do. I'd rather the colleges be doing it themselves. But since they're falling down on the job and not allowing any debates on public policy issues, I think it's very appropriate and necessary for the legislature to step in.
Stanley Kurtz, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Mark.